Great. Yeah, well, thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Things are a little crazy at the moment. I gave a presentation this morning at the IOGA conference, and in it I said that although I was going to be very sad when Cassini was over, I'm beginning to be quite relieved as well, because I can't keep this pace up, huh?
For sure. Oh, well, so what were you speaking on today?
I was actually talking a little bit about some of the results we're getting from the end of mission phase of Cassini, known as the grand finale.
Yes.
One of the real surprises about the observations we've made of Saturn, and they're similar to what was seen by the Pioneer and the Voyager spacecraft, is that the magnetic field is very different to magnetic fields that you expect in large planets. And so we're hoping that this end of mission phase is going to allow us to better understand it. So it was a little cagey because we're still calibrating our data and we're still getting data back all the time. But it's beautiful data, and it's nice to be able to tell people about it, you know?
Yeah. When you say difference, do you mean different to what you've seen at the other large planets, or just to what?
Yeah, I don't know how much science detail you'd like me to go into, but all planets in the solar system that have internal planetary magnetic fields generated by the dynamo process in the interior have got a large tilt between the rotation axis of the planet and the magnetic or the dipole axis.
Right.
And people's understanding of how planetary dynamos operate is that you need that non-axisymmetry to be able to generate the field. At Saturn, we're not seeing a tilt at all. We thought by going in really close inside of the rings, we would begin to see a tilt of some kind. But based on the data we have at the moment, it's incredibly small. And so that's going to make people rethink either how planetary dynamos operate.
Yeah. Oh boy, this network is being so unpredictable today. Oh my goodness. I've just had about a minute's silence. Are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, suddenly you're working. Man, this network is just full of nonsense. Okay. So before we cut off then, it sounds to me as if everything we think we know about where the magnetic fields come from in the first place might not be right.
Well, it's just, we know they're generated by a planetary dynamo in the interior, but it's people's understanding of how their planetary dynamo operates
that
has been questioned a bit.
Okay. All right, well, let me get back onto my notes here since I... just sort of having a nice conversation. So you got your doctorate at the University of Natal.
Yes, I did.
Or what used to be called the University of Natal, anyways.
Yeah, that's right. I actually got my degree in applied mathematics and physics, and then I did an honors year in physics, and then I did a PhD in applied mathematics. I hadn't looked at a piece of data in my life until I went to Imperial College. So... you sort of find your way as you go, huh? My first view of Saturn was when I was a kid in South Africa. My dad built his own telescope. He ground the mirror and everything. Mm. And my sister and I were so proud of ourselves. We sort of mixed the base for the concrete of the telescope. And we thought, of course, that was the most important thing about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I had a view of Saturn, and you could just make out its rings. It was a 10-inch telescope. Never thinking I'd end up doing what I'm doing. You know, it's fantastic. Really is.
Were you at the Maritzburg or the Durban campus?
I was at the Durban campus, yeah.
Were you from Durban or?
I was actually born in Johannesburg, but when I was about 6 months old, my parents moved down to Durban and my dad worked at the University of Natal. He was a civil engineer. And in fact, when I went to high school, the school I was at didn't do science. And so my first year of university was terrifying because I was doing physics for the first time. I'd go home every evening and I was still living at home at that time. And my dad would go through all the lecture notes with me. And slowly, but surely, I began to understand what was going on.
That's interesting. Just going off script for a moment. You know, I never graduated myself, and I've tried a few times and lots of excuses as to why I've never finished. But my most recent efforts have been at UNISA, where unusually for a distance college, you still get to go in for practical sessions. And in an astronomy practical and the physics practical, I met a lot of students who had come from the previously disadvantaged areas, you know, these nasty old Bantu education schools.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which 20 years later are still pretty rubbish. And it was amazing to see these guys, man, they were so lacking the fundamentals, and all they needed was someone just to sit them straight. Me having had the benefits of having done first year about, you know, more than once to be able to just sit down and say, well, when it says this, it just means that, and bam, like that. So it's just the what a difference. It's just a bit of mentorship to get you through when you don't have that background.
Absolutely. But, you know, you can do it. I think the example you've just cited and the example of me, you can move into an area that you don't have basic training in. You just have to be able to put your mind to it and try and get someone to actually help you out. And, you know, so that you don't feel stupid asking questions that you know you should know the answer to, but you just haven't ever done it before.
Yes. So what was your PhD on?
I looked at the outflow of winds that come off from galaxies and come off from the sun. And I did modeling using computers. And, you know, when I say I never looked at data, I mean it was the data that was trying to inform the models we were going to put together. But I never got my hands dirty myself with looking at data.
Right, right.
But, you know, now I'm responsible for a team and an instrument that's taking data all the time. And it's amazing how you can move into different areas. If it's something that interests you and an opportunity opens itself up, then you can do things you never thought you'd actually end up doing.
Yes. Well, speaking of, I mean, you're at Imperial College now, and you've been on several robotic space missions. I mean, you're principal investigator for the magnetometer on what do you say, magnetometer? I think I was.
Magnetometer is perfect. Yep.
All right. On the Cassini-Huygens mission, how on earth did you get there? I mean, what was the career path to get out of South Africa and into there?
I was very fortunate. I was in the right place at the right time. You know, I know people say that you make your own fortune, but I think I was very lucky in a sense. When I left South Africa, I went to Germany for 2 years to the Max Planck Institute. And there I was still working on theory rather than anything else. Hmm. And after Germany, I wasn't quite ready to come back to South Africa. So I went to, I had a couple of job offers in the UK, and I decided to go to Imperial College. And I started working with the person who was originally the principal investigator on the magnetometer. And he was offered a job at the European Space Agency as director of science. And he needed someone to take over from him on Cassini. And when he asked me, I was absolutely terrified, to be frank. I'd never led a team in my life. You know, I was still learning about data. But I think David Southwood, that was the man, he saw something in me that I didn't know I had, and he knew that I'd be able to do it. But it was a very steep learning curve to begin with. For a long time, I pretended I knew what I was doing, but after a while, myself as well as everyone else, you know.
Yes.
In fact, after Cassini is over, I'm also being selected to build a magnetometer instrument for the European Space Agency JUICE mission, which is going to go to Jupiter and orbit around its moon. That was done based on the experience I've built up in the last 20 years. But the initial move into working on Cassini was really based on faith that David Southwood had in me, I think. And I'm just glad I was able to follow through on that.
Wow, that's such an opportunity. I can dream, but at least I get to talk to people who've done it. It's such a high profile mission, but I think most of it is, you know, from the cameras, those incredible images that they've been returning. What would you say though? Well, I suppose all the publicity goes to what the cameras get, but I mean, you must have discovered quite a bit using your instruments. What would you say was most interesting?
I think up till now, you know, what we will find about the interior of Saturn might be the most high-profile thing by the end. But I think the most important discovery that the magnetometer team made was we essentially led to the discovery of this outgassing of water vapor, this water vapor plume from one of the small moons of Saturn called Enceladus. We had two flybys of Enceladus back in 2005, and based on the observations that we made, we persuaded the project to take us much closer on a subsequent flyby. Because what the observations were telling me was that there was something that was happening with Enceladus. It was almost as if there was an atmosphere there stopping the magnetic field lines of Saturn from penetrating down onto the surface.
Right.
Not all of the teams on Cassini supported us changing the mission to go close, but the majority of them did. And I must confess, I didn't sleep for two or three nights before that close flyby, because if we hadn't seen anything, no one would ever have believed anything I said again. But what we found was that there were these cracks at the south pole of Enceladus through which internal heat was leaking out. There was water vapor coming out, organic material, dust. And so this is now one of the places in the solar system where people will look for the potential for life to form. And so, you know, from my perspective, that's probably the most high-profile thing we've done as a team so far.
I was going to ask how a magnetometer can tell you that there's water vapor, but I suppose you've touched on that already. Was it just the magnetic field not behaving the way you expected it to, or...?
That's right. What happened is that the water vapor became ionized, and if a plasma is ionized, it'll essentially not allow the magnetic field to traverse through it. So, you know, a bit like on the Earth, the upper regions of the atmosphere become ionized, and that helps hold off the magnetic field lines from the solar wind. And so what we were seeing was, instead of the magnetic field essentially just passing through the moon and not seeing it at all, if it was a dead body, that's what you'd expect. Instead, what we found was that the Saturn magnetic field lines were being draped up.
Saturn's magnetic field. Yes. Right, of course, yes.
Yeah. But in addition to that, there was a large increase in wave activity in our data, which was generated via ion cyclotron waves. And you can actually work out which ions are doing the generating. And we calculated it was water vapor ions that were doing the actual generating.
Wow.
So,
okay.
You know, we weren't absolutely certain about what we were seeing, but I thought it was important enough that we try and persuade the project to take us close. And luckily it worked.
Yeah.
That then really, for the extended missions we've had with Cassini, that discovery then really changed the focus a little bit of the extended mission. So we had many more flybys to Enceladus after that.
Mm. In these final stages of the mission, is there anything you're expecting to see or hoping to see?
Well, for me, I think the most important thing was that the instruments and the spacecraft survive all the way to the end, because if we can get as much data as we can really close to Saturn, and we're going to be continuing to take data as we dive into the atmosphere on the final orbit, it's going to allow us to really better understand the internal planetary field and work out what the internal structure is. The reason that I think a lot of us were concerned that we would never make it through to the end of the mission is that the instruments nor the spacecraft, none of them were designed to do this. Mm. For my instrument, we have to calibrate the instrument. We need to know where the zero level of the instrument is. And it's much more difficult now. When we were launched, we had two instruments on this long boom sticking off from the side of the spacecraft. Using those two instruments in tandem, you can actually calibrate them.
Okay.
But one of them stopped working a year after we reached Saturn, the one that was built in the state. One that was built in Imperial is continuing to work today, and I'm touching wood as I say that. And so to be able to calibrate, we need to roll the spacecraft. It needs to roll around two separate axes.
Okay.
And when we're really close to the planet on these end-of-mission orbits, we're in a measuring range we haven't been in since we flew past the Earth 18 years ago. And so it was critical that we rolled the spacecraft around separate axes to be able to calibrate. And, you know, you never know whether the spacecraft's going to survive doing that, whether the instrument's going to survive. So the fact we've got as far as we have, and we're essentially 2.5 weeks away from the end of the mission, for me, that's the cherry on top of everything that we've done so far.
That's fantastic. Well, then, okay, well, so after this, you mentioned that your next is JUICE.
Yeah, we've actually started building the instrument. We'll be launched in 2022. I will be 68 when we get to Jupiter. It takes quite a long time to get to Jupiter. So I can sort of see the look on some of my young members on the team's faces. They're thinking, bloody hell, she's cranky already. What's she going to be like? But you know, in some ways, I see it as a way of paying back. I was really fortunate. I became involved in Cassini just after it was launched, and so I've had this great opportunity to do really high profile science. And so, JUICE in some ways is a way of paying back. But I've also, as of January of next year, I've agreed to become head of the physics department at Imperial College. So that's going to be a new challenge in itself.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you.
Yeah.
A scary prospect, but I'm quite excited by it as well.
So what are you hoping to see at or to find at Ganymede?
The focus is on trying to, again, understand the interiors of the different moons. Ganymede is a magnetometer person paradise because it's the only moon in the solar system that has its own internal dynamo field. But there's also a liquid ocean in which currents flow. And the magnetometer will be able to measure the size of those currents because what happens is, you know, the currents generate a magnetic field of their own, and it's the field that we measure. And so we will be able to use those measurements to work out how deep the ocean is and what its conductivity is, how salty it is. And in conjunction with the other instruments on board, then we'll hopefully get a better understanding about whether there's organic material and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think the Enceladus discovery with Cassini has really focused scientists' minds on how important understanding some of the moons of the larger planet.
Oh, sorry, we're fading a little bit there.
Okay, what was the last thing you heard?
Goodness, we're talking about the importance of studying these fields that we've learned from previous missions.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Enceladus discovery on Cassini has just put it's highlighted how important the interiors of some of these small moons at the large planets are.
Okay, yes. I'm just so blown away that the idea of there being electric currents flowing through its oceans, that's that's madness.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's really difficult. It's like trying to find needles in a haystack where the haystack is moving and changing all the time. You need to separate all of these effects out. But you can actually measure these currents which are induced at different frequencies, and that allows you to work out how deep the ocean is and whether it's a global ocean and what the salt content is.
Yes. I suppose I can imagine how that would work. I suppose not so different from using a metal detector to, you know, you're just looking at the changing fields and work it out from there.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, let's close off now. You've given me a lot of your time. What advice would you give to somebody wanting to go into planetary science or this level of physics, similar to what you're doing, say as a scholar or a student just starting out?
Don't be frightened by challenges that you haven't had before. You know, and don't be unsettled about changing field. I mean, you know, I changed field. I'm working in planetary science, which is not something I was trained in. So I think take up opportunities if they interest you. It might take a while for you to feel confident in a new field, but it's a learning process all the way. So follow your instinct.
That's interesting what you just said, because that's a common thread with the when I've asked the same question to other professional astronomers, it's always the same thing. Always you can change, you can move from field to field.
Yes, and you know, I think it's really important these days because it's so much more difficult to get into an academic university environment. But, you know, you've got to be, when I think about it now, I think there's no way that I'd get myself a permanent job, you know, when I compare myself to some of the youngsters who are coming up. So I think it's really important that you're ready to change field if an opportunity opens itself. You know, and also, you know, I think I'm quite good at convincing people that I'm confident in what I'm doing. For many years, I wasn't. I pretended that I was, and after a while, I'd convinced everyone, and I convinced myself as well, you know.
Okay, well, let me see. At this point, I normally ask if there's anything you'd like to promote or point people to. Well, I suppose in your case, there's not hard to find you. I mean, you're the first person I've spoken to who has a Wikipedia page.
But, oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I didn't have anything to do with that, I must confess. But, you know, I think people who are interested in planetary missions, keep an eye on the news around the 15th of September. The end of Cassini mission is going to be spectacular. It really is. The Jet Propulsion Lab is really good at involving the media, so I think it's going to be very high profile as well.
Yes, and I'll definitely put links to that in the show notes for this episode. Okay. Again, I normally ask if people want to give contact details, but I imagine you're probably quite busy. Let's not encourage people to bother you. Okay. Well, I won't include that part.
You know, okay. I think, you know, people can find me, my email, I'm sure, but I am.
Yes, yeah. Well then, Dr. Michelle Doherty, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
It's been an absolute privilege to speak to you, and thank you. I'll send you a link in a few weeks when this has been finished editing and it's uploaded, so you can hear for yourself how it came out.
Okay, marvelous. Thank you. Take care, huh?
All right, you too. Bye-bye.